Hi, and welcome to the Rachel Sellers Podcast, a podcast dedicated to providing free education about all things mental health. This podcast is about ending the mental health stigma and helping people cultivate a deeper awareness and understanding of themselves. Mental health education matters, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned and what I know. I'm your host, Rachel, and I'm so glad you're here. Y'all don't even know how pumped I am for this season. Season two of the Rachel Sellers Podcast is here, and we are going to be diving into all things eating disorders. Treating eating disorders is my passion, and I'm specifically passionate about educating people on the causes of eating disorders and the underlying trauma and nervous system dysregulation that really lies at the core of most, if not all, eating disorders. As a recovered therapist, I get to speak to these things from both personal and professional experience. So on this season, we're going to dive into the intersection of trauma and eating disorders. I'm going to do a lot of myth busting. We're going to talk about diet culture and weight stigma and health at every size and some of these words and concepts that may be totally unfamiliar to you. These are things that I am super passionate about providing education for and just really believe that everybody needs to know about it. So there is so much awesomeness. I just made that a word. There is so much awesomeness to come from this season. So I hope you will follow along and stay tuned. So before I dive into some of the meat, I guess, of this season, what I want to do is just give a brief overview of what are the types of eating disorders and how does someone develop an eating disorder. So the first type of an eating disorder that someone can have is something called anorexia nervosa. And this is characterized by food and emotional restriction. The emotional restriction part is huge here. We're going to dive into that in later episodes. People with anorexia have an intense and an ongoing fear of gaining weight or getting fat. There are two types of subtypes of anorexia. There's a restricting type or a binge purge type. So someone with a binge purge type has or regularly engages in binge and purging behaviors or vomiting or laxative use. The onset of anorexia is actually typically during adolescence or the young adult years. Anorexia has a really high mortality rate, one of the highest of all mental illnesses, and this is due to medical complications, not just from the disorder itself, but also because of suicide. Often clients struggling with anorexia have an obsessive exercise routine and focus really intensely on burning calories or just calories in general. So traditionally, the severity, so how severe is someone's anorexia, is measured using the BMI, the body mass index. I have a different way of referring to the BMI, and for me, that's the BS measuring index, because the BMI is literally, it's bullcrap, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about why as we continue this season, but I want you to know this now. You cannot tell if someone is struggling with anorexia by looking at them. And I'm going to repeat this a lot during this season. A person does not need to be emaciated or underweight to be struggling with anorexia. And you can be malnourished at any weight. Studies have found that larger bodied individuals can also have anorexia, although they may be less likely to get diagnosed due to cultural prejudice and bias against people in fat bodies. So when we're looking at, okay, how severe is someone's anorexia, what the current research is showing is that we need to look at weight suppression. Weight suppression is how many pounds a person has lost from their highest ever weight to the weight they are now. Weight suppression is a much more accurate measure of severity. Anorexia is also typically characterized by perfectionism, low self-esteem, and difficulties in relationships. People with anorexia typically lack self-compassion and have a very loud inner critic, meaning they're very self-critical, very critical of themselves. Control is a central issue for people with anorexia, And this desire for control is typically linked to past trauma. So what we know about trauma, trauma robs a person from control, of control. So often what we see in someone struggling with anorexia is they'll use the eating disorder behaviors as a way to fulfill that basic core need for control and power. Anorexia eating disorder behaviors associated with anorexia can also function as a means of escaping or numbing out negative emotions. Again, we're going to do so much of a deeper dive into this in further future episodes. So another type of an eating disorder is bulimia. Bulimia is characterized by a recurrent binge eating, and compensatory behaviors like self-induced vomiting or the use of laxatives for the purposes of preventing weight gain. So like anorexia, there is this fear of gaining weight. And also similar to anorexia, there can be serious medical complications, although the medical complications associated with bulimia are a little bit different. So some of those might be esophageal lacerations, all sorts of tummy issues like gastric ruptures, as well as cardiac arrhythmias. This is really interesting, something a lot of people don't know. A history of sexual abuse is a risk factor that is involved in the development and maintenance of bulimia. This doesn't mean that sexual abuse causes bulimia. It just means that based on the research, there is a significant association or correlation between sexual abuse and bulimia. Purging symptoms have also in general been significantly associated with trauma, and they often serve as a way to deal with just this overwhelming rush of emotions and in a sense to physically get them out, to purge them of the body or from the body. Another common type of eating disorder is binge eating disorder, and this is actually the most common eating disorder, and it's really misunderstood, pretty highly stigmatized, and I've got a lot of myths to bust about this one in our next episode. But for now, I'll just say this. Binge eating disorder is characterized by eating large amounts of food in a short period of time. The person struggling feels completely out of control during the episode. Some will describe it as like an out-of-body experience. They feel like they cannot stop. They often feel a deep sense of shame and guilt and self-hatred over these behaviors. And people struggling with binge eating disorder often struggle with depression, low self-esteem, and a preoccupation with weight, body size, or food. I want to clarify what exactly is a binge episode. Oftentimes people will think, overeating, they'll overeat and they'll say, oh, I binged. They're not the same thing. And this can be really hard to understand in a culture where people sometimes confuse normal fullness or just slightly overeating with binging. So again, overeating is not the same as binging. During a true binge episode, a person will eat a very large amount of food in a very short period of time. Eating is very fast, and it's often done alone or in secret because of that shame that people who struggle with binge eating feel. Binge eating is also typically driven by emotions. Binging is a way to cope with, to suppress, or extinguish negative emotions. What we know is when we eat, our brain releases mood-enhancing neurotransmitters that almost instantly make us feel better, providing relief from emotional pain. So contrary to popular belief, dieting and food restriction is actually the number one reason why people binge. And this binge and restrict cycle is completely ruthless. And it looks a lot like this. So a person experiences a binge episode, or they might say they give into a craving. They might feel guilty. They feel like they failed. And so this shame and this regret leads then to restriction, eating less than normal amounts of food or only eating certain types amount of food, which then leads to obsessing about food. Food deprivation leads to food obsession. This is not a matter of willpower. This is what our brains do when they're hungry. And And eventually biology overrides willpower and leads back to that binge. So we see this cycle, this binge and restrict cycle. It's really common just of diets in general, but we also see this cycle at play a lot of times with someone that's struggling with binge eating disorder. I also want to mention something called orthorexia. So this is a newer diagnosis. It is not yet in the DSM. It is getting there. Hopefully it will be added to the next edition. Orthorexia is characterized by a fixation or a really strong desire to eat only healthy or quote unquote clean foods, or to avoid food groups entirely, or just eating foods prepared only in a certain way. I think this is really interesting. The literal meaning of the word orthorexia is proper appetite. So eating, again, in this very specific way. It's often prompted by the desire of achieving a good and healthy lifestyle. Those are not bad things. This can spiral and it can lead to malnourishment, medical complications, and even OCD. So what we see here is just this obsession with clean, healthy eating. There's typically an avoidance of quote unquote bad foods. With orthorexia, we see a lot of morality assigned to food. So there's categories of food that are good, there's categories of food that are bad. We'll dive more into kind of where this comes from in an episode when we talk about diet culture. But for now, I'll just say this. You know, our culture has normalized eating patterns and diets that are in actuality really disordered. And I'm going to say that again because I think it's really important. Our culture has normalized eating patterns and diets that are actually disordered. Things like calorie counting or not putting a morsel of food in your mouth past 8 p.m., even if you're hungry. Those things are not normal, despite them being very normalized in the culture that we live in. Again, we're going to dig into that so much deeper as we get into further seasons of the podcast. I quickly want to mention some of the lesser known eating disorders. One of those is called pica, and this is characterized by someone who ingests non-edible substances. There's also rumination disorder, which is characterized by regurgitation or vomiting and rechewing of food. Another eating disorder that's lesser known is called ARFID. That stands for avoidant / restrictive food intake disorder. ARFID manifests as kind of this disinterest of food and difficulty eating certain foods due to sensory issues. So ARFID is similar to anorexia in that both disorders involve limitations in the amount or types of food consumed. But unlike anorexia, ARFID doesn't typically involve any distress about body shape or size or fears of becoming fat. So it really is, ARFID is more tied to that sensory discomfort that people might have around certain foods. And then the last eating disorder, this isn't really a specific eating disorder. It's more of a catch-all diagnosis that the DSM created. It's called other specified feeding or eating disorders, aka if the set of symptoms that you're presenting with don't fall into a category that has already been established by the DSM, then a clinician or a therapist might assign this diagnosis of other specified feeding or eating disorder. This used to be called eating disorder not otherwise specified in previous editions of the DSM. And again, the category was developed to encompass individuals who didn't meet strict criteria for another eating disorder, but still had a significant impairment or their behaviors, thoughts, and feelings really were distressing to them and impeding on daily life. All right, so something you might be wondering is, where do these eating disorders come from? What causes them? Eating disorders are biopsychosocial mental illnesses. They are not a choice. No one would choose the hell that is living with an eating disorder. I know that from personal experience, and I know that from my clients. What biopsychosocial means is that there are biological, genetic, psychological, and social environmental factors that all influence whether someone will develop an eating disorder. Some people are genetically predisposed to having an eating disorder. And there's actually a lot of really cool research being done right now to explore that connection even more. And if that's the case, and they're also exposed to several environmental triggers, they might develop an eating disorder. So what are some of those environmental What are some of those environmental triggers? So some of those might be trauma, growing up in a dysfunctional family system, really struggling a lot with your body image, dieting, a family with a lot of food rules, or a mom or a dad who is really into dieting, society's really ridiculous beauty and size standards. All of these things are environmental factors that may influence whether someone develops an eating disorder. We can't say that there's just one thing that causes an onset of an eating disorder. It's never just one thing with any mental struggle or disorder. It's never one cause, but it comes from a complex interaction of causes. It's also, I think, important to note that people struggling with eating disorders are rarely only struggling with an eating disorder. They are typically also struggling with some other kind of mental health struggles. And some of those common ones typically include anxiety, depression, or other mood disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and personality disorders. Again, eating disorders rarely stand alone. So before I conclude this episode, I just want to be really real. I'm dedicated to doing that on this episode and any episode of this podcast. So I'm going to just straight shoot here. So many people struggling with eating disorders do not get help. And not only because of the social stigma, but also because there is this awful cultural narrative that you should be or you should look, quote unquote, sick enough to be worthy of receiving help or treatment for your eating disorder. A lot of that is honestly perpetuated, shockingly, from our medical system. And I'm not here to throw doctors under the bus and bash them. But what I will tell you is that unless an MD specializes in eating disorders, they're usually not eating disorder informed. They still operate in practice out of many old and false assumptions about health and wellness. One of those assumptions being that you have to look emaciated to have anorexia. Another stereotype that is completely false is that you have to be fat to struggle with binge eating disorder. The research disproves this entirely. You cannot tell if a person is struggling with an eating disorder just by looking at them, and you can be malnourished at any size. Why isn't this common knowledge then? Well, because of the diet industry and their quest for your dollars, as well as weight stigma, two things that I'm going to talk extensively about on this season. Even though the BMI has been totally disproven as an accurate measure of health, it is still used. Y'all, it is still used in doctor's offices. I'm going to give you like major history on the BMI in our next episode, and your mind is going to be blown. Okay, but it's still used in doctor's offices. Even though we have extensive research to prove that fitness, not fatness, is associated with health and longevity, the medical system still oppresses people in larger bodies, prescribing disordered eating behaviors to people in larger bodies. Y'all, my adolescent clients tell me horror stories about things they're being taught in their health classes or things that they heard or they're hearing about in school as things that are healthy. Last week, one of my clients struggling with disordered eating shared with me that she learned about calorie counting in health class that day. It is something that her and I are working on actively unlearning in session. And y'all, health classes are teaching that to our kids and to our teenagers. I've had clients eating as little as 400 to 500 calories a day tell me stories about ER doctors and other medical professionals saying things to them like, "You don't look emaciated enough to have an eating disorder." I wish that these stories were exceptions to the norm, but they're not. They are the norm. And yes, the tides are changing. And yes, there are so many amazing clinicians and therapists and dietitians in this field actively changing this. But we have so much work to do, so much work. And this is why I'm so passionate about eating disorder education and speaking truth to a whole lot of BS that has influenced so many young people cultivating such an unhealthy relationship with food. So I could continue on this rant, and y'all, I will in further episodes. But my point in naming this now is intentional. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, you deserve help and you deserve recovery. If you have a difficult relationship with food or your body or with exercise, and if it is taking over your life or interfering with your life, you are sick enough and you deserve to heal. So if that message resonates with you in any way, I really encourage you, reach out to a therapist, reach out to a non-diet or anti-diet, health at every size aligned dietitian or nutritionist. There are so many people who see you and understand you and want to come alongside you in your journey. I hope that you learned something new in this episode, and I hope that you stick with me on this season as we explore even more all about eating disorders. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you learned something new. Just a reminder that this podcast is about mental health and mental health concepts, and education about psychology and therapy is not a substitute for individual therapy. If you want to help this podcast grow and get it into the hands of other listeners, please subscribe, rate, or leave me a review. It really does make a difference.